When Governor Sam Brownback took office 5 years ago, he promised sweeping changes to Kansas government. I'm Kay McIntyre, and today on KPR Presents, Brownback's Kansas. It's a panel of political scientists from across the state who gathered recently in Lawrence to talk about the legacy of Governor Brownback's policies. We'll hear from Burdette Loomis of the University of Kansas, Michael Smith of Emporia State University, Mark Peterson of Washburn University, and Ed Flinchy of Wichita State University. The four contribute to a weekly political column called Insight Kansas. The opinions expressed on today's program are their own. They do not represent those of Kansas Public Radio or the University of Kansas. First, KU's Burdette Loomis, who moderated Brownback's Kansas.
Honestly, I think when Sam Brownback came into office in 2010, after the 2010 election, we all were holding our breath. We didn't really know what to expect, because for 40 or 50 years, Kansas had had a very, what I would call, moderate conservative government. It modernized its government in the 60s and early 70s. We've had Democratic and Republican governors over the years, generally a Republican legislature, but not a far-right Republican legislature. And so at the end of the day, governors and the legislature pretty much got together on a moderate conservative agenda, which is probably very close to where the state was. It's public opinion over that time. Generally speaking, I think the state was governed reasonably well, a good education system, good roads, not a disproportionate amount of debt, on and on. 2010 came, and although we'd had some movement to the right, Christian right, and to an extent the fiscal right, the Americans for Prosperity, 2010 was a national election against Obama, Obamacare, that moved 700 state legislators into office across the nation. In Kansas, we elected Sam Brownback, a very conservative governor, and a very far right House of Representatives. The Senate wasn't up that year. And over the next couple of years, Sam Brownback enacted some tax policies, which we'll talk about. He called it a great experiment, reduced taxes, took a lot of people off the rolls. And you also have increasingly tight abortion laws. But other things have come onto the agenda that we wonder where they ever came from, and we'll talk about that. But I think, although we'll slip into usage of the term conservative, this has not been a conservative movement at all. Much like other places, this is a movement, from my perspective, that is a far right movement that has dominated the governor's office in both houses of the legislature since 2012. And in that instance, the Kansas politics has taken a sharp, sharp right turn from this moderate conservative consensus that we've had over the past 40 years or so up to 2010. So with that kind of little introduction to Kansas politics, we'll start with Ed, and we'll all talk a little bit about some greater specifics about what we're interested in as we look at Sam Brownback's Kansas.
That's Burdette Loomis of the University of Kansas Department of Political Science. He's moderating a panel called Brownback's Kansas. First up, Ed Flinchy, who started teaching political science at Wichita State University back in 1979. He's the co-author of Kansas Politics and Government, The Clash of Political Cultures.
Let me try to give an overview, a quick overview, a fairly complicated picture of state finance under Brownback, and maybe highlight the departure that Brownback has taken. I bring some biases to the table in the sense that I would summarize the Brownback five now almost 6 years as deficit spending. In other words, spending more than revenues are coming in, unfair taxes, and excessive debt. And all those don't sound like far-right positions in many ways. Let me talk a little bit about them. Let me comment first on taxes. Brownback departed from what Byrd described as a moderate conservative understanding that actually prevailed for most of the 20th century in Kansas, and that was a three-legged stool of public finance. Essentially, equity among property taxes, income taxes, and sales taxes. And that was indeed a bipartisan kind of agreement. We can talk a little bit about when it started and how it evolved, but there was, I think, a bipartisan understanding that that was fair and equitable taxation. And Brownback's departure has been to essentially commit himself to the elimination of state income taxes, which were adopted back in the 30s, really at the recommendation of Alf Landon, among others. And so, essentially, a taxation system that reduced income taxes across the board for individuals, but eliminated income taxes for about over 300,000 businesses and farm operations. And so the three-legged stool, according to Brownback's idea, is slowly, he hasn't been able to eliminate the income tax for individuals, but certainly for exempting businesses, he's cutting away at that third leg of this long-term agreement on how to fund state and local government in Kansas. So there's some serious questions of fairness in this, and we can talk a little bit about that. The other thing that he's done in terms of deficit spending, and if you look at the general fund, the fund that essentially funds those core services, education, higher education, and social services, the governor relied on a sales tax increase prior to his administration to essentially make it through the first years, and that is now gone. He's also relied on transferring funds from other agencies, primarily the Department of Transportation fund, highway fund, and we're now in a desperate situation that in the last week these revenues are not coming in, and a new $13 million cut across state universities. So, and it's not clear we'll even make it to the end of the fiscal year. And I would add just one element to the finance picture that I've spent some time trying to understand, and that's a kind of an un-Republican thing of excessive debt. And we can look at highway debt, we can look at pension debt, we can look at general debt. Brownback and his legislative allies have essentially pushed the level of debt, some of which they essentially take and put into current spending, to levels we have never seen in Kansas. And so this moderate conservative agreement of caution in the use of debt has really taken a new turn.
And I think one thing we might note is that the state constitution formally requires a balanced budget. Now, there's some interpretation there, but that's been the long-term understanding. And so this is really a deviation from that understanding.
Well, what has happened, in my view, particularly with respect to highway debt, the governor and his executives have issued record-breaking debt, highway debt, and put that in the highway fund and then take transfers out of the highway fund. And is it legal? Yes. Can they say they didn't use 20-year debt for current year spending? They can assert it. But the truth is they pushed that money into the highway fund through debt and then essentially took it out to make up for the state tax cuts.
That's Ed Flinchy of Wichita State University speaking at Brownbacks, Kansas, a panel of political scientists looking at the legacy of Governor Sam Brownback. The group met March 4, 2016, as part of the annual conference of the Mid-America American Studies Association. Michael Smith teaches political science at Emporia State University.
I'm going to talk about another state executive, Secretary of State Kris Kobach, who I would not call a Brownback ally. Kobach has his own agenda. The two are rumored to dislike each other personally. I don't know if that's true or not. I don't know either of them personally. And they kind of just give each other space. Kobach was bringing Donald Trump Kansas politics to Kansas before Donald Trump was cool, and in particular this focus on the anti-immigration. And it's kind of interesting the dynamic between Kobach and Brownback, because Brownback, he does not advertise it. He hasn't advertised it for years. Of course, we know that he came to the governorship from the U.S. Senate. And as a U.S. senator, earlier in his career, around 2000, early 2001, pre-September 11th, he was a strong advocate of immigration reform that would include a path to citizenship. And in fact, he and his staff were working with Congressman Teddy Kennedy and his staff on an immigration reform bill that obviously would have been bipartisan. And there's a really interesting documentary about that that is out there floating around. Essentially, it got derailed by September 11th and a lot of the fears of who's going to get in and what are they going to do if they get into the country and terrorists and all that. But the bottom line is Brownback, the anti-immigrant politics are not what Brownback is about. He just leaves the issue alone. Kobach's a whole different animal. Kobach is very aggressive, and he's nationally known for his anti-immigration politics. The state of Arizona is well known for its anti-immigrant laws. Kobach helped write those. He helped write Alabama's laws. I think he was involved with Georgia's laws, although I'm not certain. Nebraska, thanks, Bert. And so it's not just in Kansas. He used to be a law professor at the University of Missouri, Kansas City. He has that legal background to write this model legislation. Here in Kansas, his big issue has been what he calls voter fraud and passing very aggressive legislation designed to make it a good deal more difficult to vote, more so for some people than others. I'm sure you all have heard of photo ID laws and the big debate about, do you need to present a photo ID to vote? What about people that don't have a photo ID? What about the fact that a disproportionate number of lower income people don't have a photo ID? What if there's no office locally, et cetera, et cetera? Okay, well, he certainly supports that. And the so-called SAFE Act, which he championed through the legislature in 2011, has that provision. But it has another provision that's a little different, and this is a newer wave of these restrictive voting laws, and it's called proof of citizenship requirements. Essentially, it requires first-time voter registrants in Kansas to prove that they are American citizens in order to register to vote. Arizona, which seems to parallel Kansas, possibly because they consult with Kobach about their laws, has also passed these, very similar to Kansas. Georgia has them now, and some other states are either waiting for them to take effect or looking at passing them. What this means in the real world is that if you want to register to vote, for 90% plus of the people, you have to present a birth certificate. And I think you could do a whole panel at a conference like this just on the fascination of American conservatives with birth certificates. There's something about conservatives and birth certificates. They have this thing about birth certificates, but I won't go there except to say that that's how most first-time voter registrants in Kansas will do the proof of citizenship. There are some other things allowed. A passport, which you have to prove you're a citizen to get a passport anyway. Tribal papers if you're Native American, and naturalization papers if you're a naturalized citizen. One issue that's come up, and this affects the photo ID stuff as well, is it's all well and good that the law sets forth that, for example, tribal papers can document that you're an American citizen to register to vote. If the workers at the elections office or at the polls don't know this, it doesn't do you a lot of good. And when I testified recently before the U.S. Commission on Civil Rights, some of the other people testifying, one was a woman from the Potawatomi Nation that said, I showed up. I had my tribal ID. It says right here in the SAFE Act that I have a right to register to vote. And I was denied. And she had to go through a process, took a couple of hours, you know, talk to your supervisor. You can imagine. And what ended up happening is that the poll worker was sick the day they had that training and missed the training where they taught the person, yes, tribal IDs count. And so one of the big issues I'm worried about is implementation of the laws. I have a colleague who lives here in Douglas County, went to vote, had his passport, whipped out his passport. Here's your ID. Sir, we need a driver's license. No, the law doesn't say driver's license. It says photo ID. And sure enough, I have to call my supervisor and my supervisor's supervisor and all this on a busy election day to document that a passport is a photo ID. So I have some real concerns about implementation. Bottom line on these proof of citizenship laws, we have done some research on it. We worked with the Lawrence Journal World to get a list of what are called suspense voters. Suspense voters are voters who did everything except provide the proof of citizenship when they registered to vote. So they're put on a special list. Instead of active, A for active, for their voter registration, there's an S for suspended. And then they have 90 days. That was a rule change made last year. Used to be indefinite, but it was changed to 90 days last year. They have 90 days to provide that proof of citizenship, get off the suspense voters list, and get registered as active. If they don't, they're cleared from the voter list, and then they start the entire process over again, which includes the closing dates. You have to be registered about 25 days before the election. So we pulled a list of the suspense voters, got a Kansas Open Records Law request, looked at the data, and then compared it to some data from about 8 months later. How many people, and with the 2014 election in between, how many people completed their registrations and voted? And we found that, of course, most of the suspense voters did not. Although there was a significant percent that did, more than 10% of the suspense voters did. It's not trivial. Suspense voters who complete their registrations are concentrated in certain precincts. We're in one of them right now. They're very heavily concentrated in college towns, especially here at KU, but also down in Pittsburgh State, there's a precinct with a lot. So it seems to be there's a correlation between college students and the completers. So what we worry about on the non-completers is that they're not not quite as old as the average voter, but they're older than the suspense voters who complete the median age in their 30s. And we are able to look at the census tracts, tend to be concentrated in urban areas, several in Wichita. There's one in Topeka, a couple in Johnson County. Some of those are anomalous, but it's not a perfect one-to-one relationship, but it appears to be that in the census tracts where there's more poverty, there are also more suspense voters, and in particular, suspense voters who don't complete their voter registrations. Critics of Kobach and the politics he represents, and by the way, he did endorse Donald Trump the other day, if you didn't hear. Brownback did not. Brownback endorsed Rubio, another sign of how those two are each playing a different game and just give each other space. The critics are going to say, look, these are directed at minorities, African-Americans, Latinos. They're directed at lower-income voters. I mean, who is going to have difficulty locating a birth certificate? A lot of middle-class people can just whip them out of a safe deposit box and they're good to go. Some people that were born at home, weren't born in hospitals, were never issued birth certificates. Some people do all their transactions in cash and they can't just get online and enter a credit card number to order a copy of their birth certificate. This is going to have a disproportionate impact. Again, I don't want to oversell it because our data is not showing a one-to-one relationship, but it does look like in particular some urban lower-income precincts with higher African-American populations are getting hit a little harder. The overall numbers are not that high. It's just a few percent of the voter rolls that are suspense voters. And of course, that's now dropping because the people that don't finish in 90 days are coming off the voter rolls altogether. So it's probably already hit the highest number it's going to hit now that people are coming off because they're just being removed. But it could swing a close election for state rep, close election for state senate, city council, city school board, or even, you know, if the election in Kansas, it wouldn't even have to be as close as the presidential election in Florida in 2000. If we had a gubernatorial election or something like that decided by a few percentage points. In some areas, the percentage of suspense voters is as high as 3% of the precinct. The highest is this precinct right here where we are right now, or this census tract, KU. So it could throw a close election. The other thing I'll say just quickly, I don't want to hog the microphone, is that a lot of us critics, and I'm one of the critics of the laws, don't buy the case for voter fraud. The Brennan Center at New York University has done a lot of research on this. And essentially what they've found is that what's called voter fraud by impersonation, which is essentially where you say somebody you're not, maybe you vote, or duplicate voting, where you vote twice, is very, very rare. And of course, not all voter fraud would be prevented by these kinds of laws. In particular, voter fraud where you deny someone the right to vote when they have a right to vote. This law wouldn't help too much with that. And the kind of voter fraud that these laws were designed to prevent is extremely rare. And so there's a question, you could make the argument, look, it's only a few percent of the voter rolls at the most that are suspense voters. It's not really that many people. But when you consider that Kobach had the legislature give him prosecutorial authority to prosecute voter fraud, and he's brought, I think, 6 cases, the number of people on the suspense voters list is in the tens of thousands. That's a lot more than 6. And so either way, we may not be talking about huge numbers, but the numbers of people on the suspense list is many, 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 many times the number of people that have actually been accused, not convicted, but accused of voter fraud. Some of us critics are very skeptical that this is really about voter fraud.
Michael Smith teaches political science at Emporia State University. I'm Kay McIntyre. If you're just joining us, today on KPR presents Brownbacks Kansas. It's a panel of political scientists from across the state who gathered March 4th, 2016 at the Mid-America American Studies Association Conference. Mark Peterson is the chair of the political science department at Washburn University in Topeka.
I want to talk a little bit about what I guess I would call the human ecology of Kansas politics. And I think it makes a link between the thing that Michael was just talking about with regard to Chris Kobach and the Brownback administration and the extraordinarily right-wing legislature that Kansas presently has. This has sort of fascinated me because I'm not a native Kansan, and so one of the things that I've had to do in the near 20 years that I've been here is to try and get some understanding of the place and the people who live here and what their values are. I always remind my students that once upon a time, Kansas was considered quite a progressive state in the Union. And of course, our history is unusual in the sense that Kansas is a creation of an attempt to resolve a deep national conflict over slavery. We began with the conflict between pro-slave and anti-slave interests. Abolitionists, I think people have to admit, were not exactly egalitarians. They disliked slavery. They weren't prepared to invest those who were emancipated with full civil rights and liberties. But it was a great step forward from the condition of the Republic at its founding. Out of that grew sort of a penchant for political oddballs, people with unusual views, people who were coming west, as so many did during the 19th century, to reinvent themselves. And so by the time we got to the turn of the 19th century, Kansas, before the turn of the 20th century, Kansas went through a little spasm involving the rise of populism and progressivism here on the prairie. There are historians who argue that actually Kansas played a minor role in that. Real populism was in the American Southeast. But, you know, our own history tells us that day it was a pretty big event around here. I think the thing that I always have noticed or remembered is once upon a time in Michaelstown, there was a fairly famous newspaper man named William Allen White, confidant of presidents and a fellow that people on the East Coast actually traveled out to visit here. White was quite a promoter. One of his comments that he repeated early and often was, "Things happen first in Kansas." I think indeed in the time when he was speaking in the first quarter of the 20th century, they really were. I remind my students every once in a while that at the beginning of the 20th century, Kansas had the same number of seats in the U.S. Congress as the state of California. They each had 8. Today, as we know, California, as I recall, now has 53 members in the U.S. House of Representatives, and we have 4. And if our population trends continue, there's a very good chance that by 2020 we will be reduced to 3 seats in the U.S. House. And that really gets me to the point about the human ecology of Kansas. The peak of Kansas population came in the 19-teens. And since that time, the population of the state of Kansas in relation to its position in the overall population of the country has been declining. We continue to grow a bit, but we grow at a much slower rate than the rest of the country. For example, I looked in preparing my thoughts for today at the difference in population growth since Brownback's year of election in 2010. And America is like its Western European allies and other developed nations in the world not growing at a particularly fast rate. Were it not for the thing that Kris Kobach dislikes the most, we wouldn't be growing. Immigration has accounted for the lion's share of growth in the last couple of decades in the United States, both from the standpoint of people coming into the country, but also the fact that immigrants, by and large, are young, fit adults who are taking a main gamble on life. And if they get here and they find stability, they make families. And so birth rates amongst recent immigrants and first-generation children of immigrants is higher than it is for the overall population. So according to the Census Bureau, since 2010 until the mid part of this decade, 2015, the country has grown at the rate of about 0.8% annually. So we've gone from right at 309 million to about 320 million, according to the Census Bureau. Kansas, on the other hand, and I rounded, which is sort of unfair, but Kansas has been plus or minus the rounding error involved in 50,000 to 100,000 individuals, has been 2.9 million individuals since 2010. That works out, according to the data, to a 0.4% rate of population growth in the state of Kansas. So we are one half of the national rate, which isn't stellar in its own right, but really means that Kansas is gradually becoming a smaller and smaller dot on the landscape in terms of human population. Another thing that has fascinated me has been the migration patterns within the state itself. That peak of proportional relationship to national population that I spoke of back in the 19-teens involved a very substantial rural population. About 40% of the state's population lived on the farm and out west, to put it in one way. And since that time, the rural portions of Kansas have been emptying out. Today, the first congressional district stretches from the Colorado border to within 40 miles of the Missouri border, and it reaches the Nebraska and it reaches the Oklahoma borders, and it comes as far east in terms of major population areas as Manhattan, 50 miles west of Topeka. And Goodland is on the other end. Some of those counties have actually fewer humans in them, I suspect, than just about any other form of fauna that you can find in the territory. Their median ages of many of those northwestern counties of the state are now over 50 years of age. The median population of the state itself is 36 years of age. So the West is emptying. There are fewer and fewer young people. Another thing that I looked at was what I consider to be sort of a vital age cohort in the state in terms of predicting its future dynamic and ability to thrive and prosper, and that's the age category between 20 and 39, no longer adolescents, not yet fully settled adults, people who are capable of going somewhere else. In the decade before Brownback's election in 2000, there were 746,600 individuals in the state who fell in that demographic category. And in 2010, when Brownback was elected to office, that same cohort had 754,600 individuals in it, according to the Kansas data that was available from KU here. That's 1.1% growth in 10 years. When you look at the age cohorts of adolescents, finishing high school and going to or going to college or going into the workplace, you see an actual decline in population over those 10 years. In other words, people ask me often, how are you, Mark? And I say, I'm ripening to perfection. Kansas is ripening. It is aging. And one could make a strong case for many of the things that Sam Brownback admits to at times in his rhetoric as being important things to consider. The difficulty is the rhetoric and the politics that surrounds it. We have to do something about the fact that we maintain 300 school districts in this state, each of them with its own set of administrative overheads, many of them with colossally expensive transportation routes, all of them charged legally with the responsibility of providing an education that prepares young people for moving into the modern world, and with ever more limited resources within their territories to support those things. We have a tremendous problem confronting the costs of providing services to the elderly and the disabled. We have a sort of a cultural disjoint that has developed in the state between its urban areas and its rural heritage and background. The politics of Johnson County, of Sedgwick County, most of the counties of northeastern Kansas, in terms of what the population expects from government, the services that they're looking for, the manner in which government should operate, are vastly different from what people out in West Kansas expect. So it's entirely possible that a traditionally conservative politician with a rhetoric that says we need more efficient, we need more economical, we need more adaptable government, perhaps providing fewer services in some cases, and perhaps addressing these very difficult problems of telling people that it simply isn't possible to do what you expect, given the amount of resources that you're prepared to commit to the undertaking, that could have been done. It's parlous ground for a politician. Look at people like Paul Wellstone and Paul Tsongas and Jimmy Carter, who at various times in their careers essentially gave those eat your peas policy statements said, you know, you're going to have to face up to some realities here, folks, and the public objected. Here in Kansas, however, we've developed something new to add to the pot, and that is that we have developed this rhetoric, which we've seen around the country, and in fact Republicans are now beginning in these recent weeks to talk about with regard to the phenomenon of Donald Trump. We have vilified government. We've made government the agent of catastrophe. It is the thing that has caused these problems. It's not what people choose to do. It's not what people decide at the ballot box. It is instead faceless bureaucrats, global forces, bad ideas. As some of you have probably noted in listening to the campaign rhetoric, descriptions of the condition that go almost to the point of suggesting that somehow or another we're living in a catastrophe. Contrast that with this morning's news that last month we created 242,000 jobs in this country. Our unemployment rate is at 4.9%. And in spite of a global economy that's in pretty sick condition, ours continues to move ahead and grow, at least at a sustainable, if not a rapid rate. And it's as though, you know, the drama and the fiction has come to eliminate the reality. So here in Kansas, what we've done and what our governor has done and what many of the people who've been elected to the legislature in the wake of that rhetoric have done is we've gone out and we found new tools for justifying policy. One of them that I came across as I was preparing for today was a conference that the legislature had in May of 2013. This is in the wake of the governor's election and then the advocacy for the reduction in the income tax rates that he plumped for and got. Actually, he has admitted a time or two more than he had actually expended. But in May of 2013, the legislature got together because at the end of the session, because they realized that the impact of what they had done was going to prove to be significantly greater than what it originally forecast. And let me add a sort of a little footnote there, and that is that the idea of the income tax was brought to Governor Brownback, or at least the seminal characteristics of it, he alleges, came from a fellow who's known to lots of people who followed Republican fiscal practices for 30 or 40 years, a guy named Art Laffer. And Dr. Laffer, an economist, was hired by the Brownback administration to provide consultative services on the subject of how to structure our income tax. Dr. Laffer is also a client of an outfit called ALEC, the American Legislative Exchange Council, which is a think tank that is supported heavily by the brothers of the four-letter word that folks like us talk about here, the Koch brothers. And they had prepared a report called Rich States, Poor States. And the president of our state Senate, Senator Susan Weigel from Wichita, commented to the newspapers at the time that cutting the income tax was just the right thing to do, that we need to put the state of Kansas on the basis of relying on consumption taxes. And Dr. Laffer's report, which ALEC funded, showed that there's no correlation between lower sales taxes and economic growth. But however, there's a clear correlation between states that have no income tax and tremendous economic growth and creation of jobs. We've been raising our sales tax to little effect, good effect, that the rates have not brought in more revenue. Cutting the income taxes will cause jobs to grow exponentially. The Kansas City Star columnist, Yale Abaholka, yesterday did one of his comments and pointed out that thus far in 2016, we've created exactly 9,500 jobs in the state of Kansas. I didn't ask for a source, so I don't know that I'd trust the number. But the point is that had it been characterized as a need for efficiency in economy, the Brownback administration might be going into the books as the gubernatorial administration that really grappled with the changes that have occurred in Kansas. Instead, we have a situation in which his approval ratings, according to the Fort Hays State polls, docking institution polls, are lower than President Obama's. And I suspect that were the governor facing a run for his third term in office, the challenge might be a hill too tall or a bridge too far for him.
Mark Peterson is the chair of the Political Science Department at Washburn University in Topeka. Burdette Loomis teaches political science at the University of Kansas.
I'd like to put Kansas in a little bit of the context of the Midwest. I grew up 20 miles from Ohio in western Pennsylvania. I always consider myself Midwestern. For one thing, you could drive 20 miles and get 3-2 beer. I went to college in Minnesota, went to grad school in Wisconsin, taught in Illinois, taught in Indiana, and now teach in Kansas. So I've been on the eastern edge, and I think Kansas is kind of the western edge, and I've been all along the sort of the northern tier of the Midwest. And I think that all the states in the Midwest have undergone the kinds of pressures that we've been talking about, fiscal pressures in particular, how to deal with national regulation, stuff like that. And I'd argue that that focusing on the Midwest as to try to generalize is really difficult because the political cultures of each of these states is quite different, and how they react to the forces is quite different, and indeed their economic situations are different. I mean, we don't have a Flint, Michigan here, or a hollowing out of Detroit. On the other hand, we don't have a state government that's been more aggressive in pursuing both revenues and policies as something like Minnesota. So, how does the forces that are affecting Kansas affect other states? And one of my arguments is that the election of 2010, with this election of so many Republican legislators, that election changed the face of politics, both at the national level. It brought in John Boehner and the Republicans running the House, so you had much more potential for gridlock at the national level. But it also brought in to many states, Wisconsin, Michigan, Ohio, Kansas, Indiana, a much more Republican and a right-wing Republican government. It varied from state to state, of course. We've touched on a couple of the hallmarks here. One is an antagonism toward government. If you think of state government, here it is in the middle. You've got the federal government in Washington. You've got local government often operating on home rule within the state. And many of these state governments, and Kansas in particular, I think, has been highly antagonistic to the federal government. We sue the federal government on everything, environment, health care, you name it. Our legislators vote unanimously against Obamacare. And so there's a tremendous antagonism toward the federal government, and particularly the Obama administration. At the same time, the state government that's antagonistic toward the federal government is also highly antagonistic toward local government. Mm-hmm. And so it has swept into its reach funds from local government. It has restricted what local government can do in certain policy areas. And right now, the state government is considering a law that would take a substantial amount of local traffic tickets and sweep it into the state funds. Largely, I don't think there's any ideology there. I think it's funds are available. This puts tremendous pressure on local government. This is not a small C conservative notion at all. In many ways, it is the reversal of policies that have been going on for a long time. Other states do other things. Wisconsin, a great state of public education over the years. You have Scott Walker attacking the University of Wisconsin in staggering, unprecedented kinds of ways. You have a Republican governor in Illinois who really will not even cooperate with the legislature. They are far apart. They don't have a budget. It's staggering. Even someone like John Kasich, who appears as the moderate in Republican debates, has done a variety of fairly far right things. We're not even talking about social issues right now, which is a whole other thing. The point is that to look at the Midwest as some place that has unifying characteristics, I'm not sure is right. I think what's fascinating is to see how the battles play out in state after state, and see if we can find some parallels. I think the attack on higher education is there. And then in general, the attack on public education is there, with some notable exceptions, Minnesota being one of them. And so what I'm thinking here is that we often think of states copying policies from each other regionally. What I'd argue is that in the United States today, that with the internet, with the ease of communication, and with the organizational importance of the American Legislative Exchange Council, ALEC, very conservative organization, model legislation, that one deep red state will model another deep red state, maybe Louisiana looking at Kansas. Oklahoma loses a lot of revenue, looks to see how another state has dealt with it. Oklahoma has just had a huge revenue loss. And so I was just putting down states that have gone very far deep red. Louisiana, North Carolina, probably the most progressive state in the South for most of the 20th century, has been taken over with a far-right politics. Illinois, Wisconsin, still Wisconsin certainly has elements of a strong Democratic Party. You have Tammy Baldwin. You may get Russ Feingold back again in Wisconsin. On the other hand, you have a governor, highly anti-union, that did a lot of damage. Louisiana, in the race to the bottom, Kansas is certainly a powerful contestant, but Louisiana has got there first. Bobby Jindal's out of office. If you want to see where states are going with this far-right regime, losing tax revenues, being antagonistic toward government, Louisiana's a great place to start. So the final thing I'd say about these states is, although they're antagonistic toward the federal government, particularly the Obama administration, they want more control over the local government, they are also antagonistic toward their own state government. And the way this happens is that bureaucracies are hollowed out. You have less revenues. You cut back, do with less. Government is not seen as significant. It's not valued very highly. And in the state of Kansas, without any question, although the evidence is more anecdotal than it is systematic, you have increasingly in state government a kind of religious spoils system. So we look back at the progressive era, we go, oh, gee, there's machine politics and the spoils system. To the winner went the spoils. We put into place neutral bureaucracy. We put into place rules and regulations. And in many ways, the Brownback administration has turned the clock back, not to make it more partisan necessarily, although partisanship is part of it, but to make it almost, in some instances, a religious test to serve. Are you a fundamentalist? Do you belong to a certain kind of church or a certain church? Now, again, that's very hard to get at, and it's often anecdotal. But what you end up with is making a climate of government within the state that is oppressive in many ways, and people voluntarily leave government. They are replaced with people who are generally not as competent and certainly more ideological, both partisan but also in terms of being fundamentally Christian in many ways. This is a very different government 5.5 years in than it was at the end of this era of however many years we want to talk about it, 50 or 60 or whatever years of moderate conservative government, where people, I think, really did care about governing. I'm not sure, and this gets us right back to Trump, that we really don't seem to be caring about governing. And as political science professors, I think we care a lot about it. And certainly as for Ed, as both a professor and an administrator, it's a staggering change. And it's one that we look at, I think, in a very depressing way. And I think that it's being repeated in other states, whether it's Michigan or Wisconsin or Illinois, certainly in Louisiana, North Carolina, around the country. So the Midwest exemplifies many of these issues, but my sense is we're talking about a national phenomena that visits itself on states in distinct ways, based on, as Mark was talking about, that state's history.
Again, Burdett Loomis of the University of Kansas Political Science Department. He was joined by Michael Smith of Emporia State University, Mark Peterson of Washburn University, and Ed Flinchy of Wichita State University for a panel on Brownbacks, Kansas. To close out the hour, we'll hear some predictions for post-Brownbacks, Kansas from Mark Peterson and Ed Flinchy.
Well, Dwayne Gosin, who's not here today, has said in a couple of different venues that it will take at least a generation for Kansas to dig out of the fiscal problem that it's got. If you consider that we've got $1 billion worth of Capers bonds to be paid off over 20 years, one of the problems that exists, I think there are a number of people in Topeka who now think, they don't express, that maybe that income tax cut was a little more dramatic than it ought to have been. But everybody in politics knows that the voters don't view paring the damage and bringing the rates back up to something that will provide a stream as being just an adjustment to the system. That's a tax increase. And a tax increase is a thank you very much for your service. We're putting somebody new in your seat. So it's going to take a long time. And if what I've looked at in terms of demographics continues to bear, and I think it will, you've got the double problem that in the absence of a robust economy and something magical happening in terms of new markets for Kansas products or innovation of some sort, note what's happened to the Bioscience Authority, it's highly unlikely that there's going to be a renaissance economically in Kansas that's going to create that rising tide that lifts the boats. So a generation, perhaps.
One thing that Brownback did was way oversell cutting income taxes as a stimulus to the economy. And, you know, the federal tax structure is 5, 6, 7, 10, 12 times the impact of the state. And I think we may enter with what's going on, red states going one direction, blue states another. And it depends on this national election of a time when there's a growing federal involvement in a whole array of things, and the state elected officials are, you know, fighting against it, but not controlling the votes. And, you know, Brownback, on the one hand, blasts the federal government and then goes to Manhattan to dig a shovel of the impasse, or comes down to McConnell Air Base and extols the virtues of the Defense Department's expansion. I think we may see another kind of elevation of federal policy addressed to the big states and the urban areas, but also affecting the smaller states.
You've just heard Brownbacks, Kansas, recorded March 4th, 2016 at KU's Memorial Union. I'm Kay McIntyre. KPR Presents is a production of Kansas Public Radio at the University of Kansas.